All right, thanks. So as Lars mentioned, this is a program that is on neurophysics of space, time, and learning. Many of you know a lot more about space and time. In fact, I did my PhD on how Dirac fermions go to Euclidean space. And there's an interesting story there, but I'll not get into that right now. So what is neurophysics of space, time, and why are we so excited for 6 weeks? So here's the big problem, and that this problem is called, how does the mind emerge from the brain? So that's the big question that huge number of people are interested in. Mind is something right now I'm interacting with you, and you're using your mind. My words, actions are mine. Your actions are also mine. And the way we are interacting is through your brain. And the brain is pretty complex. In human brain, there are 10 to 11 neurons. Depending on who you are, that's not too many. Much smaller than Avogadro's number. But the key thing is that the neurons are connected to each other, which makes them very different for the body. And each neuron is connected to about 10 to 4 other neurons. And the way you draw these pictures, which should become quite relevant, is something like this. These are the input regions. This is the cell body. This is some other little thin thing that goes out called output. I'm going to give names to this. From here to here is about 1 millimeter. The cell body is about 10 micrometer. And these giant branch-like processes that are going on, they are called dendrites. And on these dendrites are these connections called synapses, about 10^4 of them. And then this neuron sends out a projection called axon or output that goes to another 10,000 neurons. And the whole show begins, these neurons are sitting around a huge amount of energy, about 1/3 of all the energy spent by your body is to maintain this brain going. And each neuron is sitting around at minus 65 millivolt. If you stuck an electrode here at the cell body, this neuron is sitting around at minus 65 millivolt. And if something happened, these synapses which are there, they inject current into the neurons of different ionic concentrations. And if the total depolarization of the neuron goes above minus 45, the neuron goes nonlinear. And it generates something called a spike. And the spike lasts about 1 millisecond. It's about 100 millivolt in amplitude. And that's the currency. And that's what pretty much everything that we have been discussing is focused on. And in fact, most of the stuff about how the brain works is based on these spikes, also called action potentials. Now, these action potentials, the spikes are pretty rare. They occur about once a second. That's pretty rare. So rest of the time, the neuron is cooking along, and we need to know, and new technology is coming up to know what is the neuron doing the rest of the 99.9% of the time. If we have time, we'll get into that. And now here is the whole thing. And there is one more bit of information that you need, and I'll keep this in the middle, that there are two types of neurons. Excitatory neuron and inhibitory neurons. Excitatory neurons are such that when this neuron fires a spike, through some neurotransmitters and receptors and chemistry, its effect on other neurons is to make it more likely to spike. Inhibitory neurons are such that their effect on the other neurons is to shut them down. And these are in a minority. These guys are about 10 to 20%. The rest are these guys. And there are many, many other cell types in the brain, glial cells within the neurons. There are many, many types of neurons. Long story. Yeah.
Stupid question. Is a neuron always excitatory or inhibitory, or it depends on the vertex, depends on the line joining you and me?
Pretty much for now, let's just assume that for 99.9% of the time, a neuron is either excitatory or inhibitory. Okay. Gets complicated, but that's called Dale's hypothesis
So the nodes of the network have properties rather than the bonds in the
network. No, that's right. So once the neuron sends out projection, all of its 10,000 projections will be excitatory. Or all 10,000 will be inhibitory, okay. Roughly. But it gets more complicated, but let's just stick to it. Yeah? Anything else? So That's what it is. And this is how this circuit is cooking along. Some environmental stimuli come in, such as when you're looking at me. In your eye, there are photoreceptors. They are turning light into certain amount of ions. And immediately, your brain converts that currency, such as light, into its own currency called spikes. And intensity, the orientation of stimuli, the contrast of stimuli, sound, light, smell, texture, flavor, you name it. Everything that comes out from the periphery is turned into spikes, and vice versa. All the actions are doing too are generated from the same thing called spikes. They go to the muscles and they activate the muscles, they make them contract or expand. So these two parts are called neural coding and decoding. Neural coding roughly says that something is coming from somewhere. At the periphery, it's coming from the outside. And once you go one synapse away from the periphery, it's all coming from inside. So how is that system putting that together and generating certain representation of stimuli? That's called roughly neural coding. And how is that representation being read out? By someone, effectively a muscle. But through many, many connections, that's called decoding. And this gets even more complicated, especially when you are within the brain, as to who is coding and who is decoding is non-trivial. So that is the currency, and this is how the circuit is going on. And the idea is that this emergent property of this neuron spiking and inhibiting and exciting each other and throwing neurotransmitters and so on, that is how we work. That's how mind arises. And there is one more very basic hypothesis, which is to keep in mind that everything at the end you can turn into information, that information is represented by the spiking rate, roughly speaking. Now that's heavily interesting, very important point, which says that every neuron, when it says, I don't know, right now outside, when I'm looking here, this is bright versus this is dark, the way that neuron conveys it is through the mean activity rate, the mean rate at which the neuron generates spikes. That's called a rate code, because it's probabilistic, it's highly stochastic, the every timing of spikes is pretty noisy, and that's your rate code. And the way the information is stored, once the stimulus is gone, you still have memory. Whatever you learn in your childhood, you are still using right now, that memory is stored in the strength of synapses. So synaptic strength, some synapse gets bigger, some get smaller. That is where memory is stored. That's how memory is stored. And in particular, majority of the information is focused on the hypothesis that this excitatory synapses, they are the ones which carry the bulk of storing information. And in fact, it's the excitatory neuron's activity which carries the bulk of representing the information itself. The inhibitory guys are more or less what most people call like shepherd dogs. They're just out there to keep these excitatory neurons in check so it doesn't run out of control. I'm going to show you that that's not likely to be the case, but these are the main hypotheses. And now from this, everything is supposed to happen. The brain learns, based on that, you generate some actions, new stimuli come in, you generate more actions that get stored once again, and you keep cooking along. This is the most general thing in field of systems neuroscience, no matter roughly what field you are studying. Now, what is it that we are interested in this program? We are interested in something called space. So there are many ways in which you can study the brain. You can ask, and as many people have asked, here is exactly one little bright stimulus, I turn on at 0 milliseconds, what is the response? We can study that, and it's quite interesting how sensory stimuli are translated into certain neural responses. But here's the other part of the story, which has got to do with how do you actually represent complex things, which we all use. Many, many complex things, and many of these we can't study. So what's some complex things that the animals do, which we can study, and one of the most complex things that any animal must do is space. So if an animal left its nest and started to walk, that animal instantly must make a map of space, immediately. Otherwise, the animal cannot make its way back. The offsprings are gone, the animal is out of the gene pool, and it's game over. So how do we make map of space, and where is the brain part which is making maps of space? So major breakthrough came all the way in 1973 by O'Keefe and Dostrowski. They had a little cylinder. In the cylinder, they had chocolate rain, roughly speaking. They were throwing bits of food randomly, and the rat had to just run around. And here, there are some stimuli. There's something here, there's something else here, there's something here, there's some other stimulus here, so on and so forth. It's about a meter large. And you throw this stuff, and the rat starts to wander around, and that's the path of the rat. He keeps wandering around, and so on and so forth. And while he's doing it, to measure the spiking rate of one neuron, and this required quite a bit of technology development, because these electrodes are really tiny. The neuron is really tiny, 10 micrometers, so you got to get really close to a neuron, and when the brain is sloshing around, the rat is running around, you don't want to kill the neuron, but still you want to pick up the signal, you don't want to pick up the 60 hertz noise. So required quite a bit of technology as well, which we are not getting into. But when all of this works, you find pretty remarkable thing that there is a neuron that spikes only in this region. So when the rat's going anywhere else, doesn't fire. Right here, when the rat is here, that neuron fires, and when he leaves, it doesn't fire. So that was remarkable. Say, what the hell happened? How can it be that one neuron has something called a cognitive map of space? So these guys are called place cells. Because they fire at a certain position, these are your place cells. So we got one ingredient of this space, time, and memory learning part, which is there is some representation of space.
I'm sorry, when you say one, you mean really one or
one.
A group of neurons?
One neuron. You can listen to only one neuron at a time.
But how do you know there may be some other ones where you didn't put electrodes?
Oh, then very good question. So now I can put, in fact, new technology has come up. And you can measure the activity of not just one neuron, but many neurons. And you'll find there is another neuron that's active here. And a third neuron, if I had color, will be active somewhere else. So on and so forth. So different neurons are different place fields. Yeah? Not all neurons are active at that spot. That's exactly right. So what is it that made these neurons active? We want to understand, and I'll come to that in a minute. The idea is supposed to be that there are these cues on the walls, on all the four walls, and the neuron can triangulate. These are called distal visual cues in the terminology. And you can add up these vectors and say, well, I'm this far from that vector and this far from the door, so I'm here, and so on and so forth, roughly speaking. Yeah?
I'm just paraphrasing the question from earlier. If I'm coding the space in the cylinder and I have a particular location, that code is actually in one neuron, not in some local area of the network?
No, that's another interesting question. So if you now look in the geometry of the brain, so if this is the top-down view of the brain and these are different neurons sitting around, and now look where the neurons are active, then this neuron may be active here and the neighboring neuron may be active somewhere else entirely. So you don't have something called topography. Okay? Absolutely, that's right. Absolutely, that's right. There are many, many neurons, and some neuron will maybe active something like this, and some maybe something like that, something like this. So it's covered pretty densely. It's not just one size. There are lots of interesting things there, and so on.
If you remove afterwards one of the cues,
yeah. So that gets into very interesting strategy. There are a bunch of papers which have suggested that actually, depending on the kind of network which is intact or not, and depending on which part of the hippocampus, sorry, I'm using terminology, let me introduce those words that I haven't used yet. It basically, depending on which part of the brain, it doesn't make too much of a difference, so it can be devastating. So for that, I need to introduce some more terminology. But before I get into that, is this much clear? Any more questions about this? So here is the deal. So this is fascinating, that there is individual neurons, their firing rate, which is pretty noisy, pretty variable, and so on, has information about where the rat is. And immediately you can ask many of the questions you have asked. What is making these neurons active? How did this get learned? Because there must be some learning component. What does it have to do with behavior? How does it help this rat find his way in the world? Because neuron is simply active somewhere. So in order to get there, we need to introduce some more bit of history. So it turns out that while people were worried about these big issues, there's actually some clinical developments. So it turns out that people have epilepsy, unfortunately. And sometimes when there's epilepsy and you can't cure it, you've got to take out that part of the brain. There's no solution, even today. Some epilepsies are not curable without taking out part of the brain. And there happened to be a patient named HM who died recently. And he had nasty epilepsy and they took out his hippocampus. A part of the brain called hippocampus. So let's add some more terminology. Hippocampus, it's a part of the brain. And hippocampus is where that place cell that I described were first found. So they take out his hippocampus, and turns out, at that time the place cells were not known. This guy had a very strange disability. And that strange disability was that he couldn't learn anything new. But he could recall everything that he had learned before his surgery pretty well. So funny kind of, and he could not just all kinds of things he couldn't learn. He could not learn facts and events, like he could learn to ride a bicycle, or he could learn to draw in some funny ways. So some motor skills, seemingly, he could learn, but he could not learn facts and events, such as you can go and have a conversation with him, and he left the room, or you left the room, and you came back after 2 minutes, he would not know who you are. You have to start the conversation again. But you can ask him what school he went to and what he did long ago, old stuff which should be really bad. He was pretty good at it, much better than this 2 minutes ago, which is entirely the opposite of what we are familiar with. I'll remember what you said pretty well, but if you ask me, you know, 10 years ago what I was doing, it'll be much crummier.
So does it have to do with Alzheimer's?
Yes, indeed. So Alzheimer's disease strikes this related part of the brain, which is near it, which is one step above it, called the entorhinal cortex. And this will get interesting soon enough. Okay? Yeah?
The way that you just described HM, it seems like learning and memory are the same thing?
Right now, I'm keeping them two parts sides of the same coin, but I'm going to differentiate it right now. Okay. So based on this, a physicist at MIT, David Marr, came up with this idea. And the ideas are, of course, rooted on the time. Those days, you know, computers were pretty, you needed pretty strong people to run computers. You needed these tape drives to take backups. So he came up with this idea that here is the input region, neocortex. So that's one region. That's right there. If you ever looked at a picture of the brain, right at the underneath the skull is the neocortex, this convoluted piece of tissue. That neocortex we know is connected to this part of the brain called entorhinal cortex, which in turn is connected to hippocampus. And his idea was that maybe the way you learn facts and events is such that neocortex sends information to hippocampus, and hippocampus learns it very quickly. Everything that's coming in, like many of you may have scratch pad and you're writing furiously, hippocampus just stores it away immediately while you are behaving. And then when you fall asleep, when there's nothing to learn, brain is still cooking along. In fact, the firing rate of neurons are only 10% less when you're sleeping compared to when you are maximally attentive. 10-20%, it's still cooking along. So the idea was that during sleep, so during learning from neocortex to hippocampus, there's this encoding going on, and during sleep, the hippocampus transfers that memory away to neocortex. And that's how you form long-term maps of space. That's the idea. So it's a two-stage process, very complex. And there are many advantages and disadvantages to this, but that's the idea. So now, in order to understand how you form memory of space and time, and this can explain why HM had this problem, because all the old memories that he formed when the hippocampus was present, they went through more or less the RAM of the computer, they went to neocortex, they were stored away, and everything was fine. But when the hippocampus is gone, it can no longer be stored. So that's why he couldn't learn new memories, but everything which was there before, that was on his hard drive, and that was not a problem. Yeah?
So you're saying space and time, but really, but then memory can be about things that are not really space and time.
Yeah, that's right.
And HM's problem is more general.
Absolutely. So that's a very good question to say, you know, what has HM's, the difficulty that the patient had was not just getting lost in space. He had difficulties, indeed, even in, you know, simple conversation. And in fact, very recently, at UCLA, people measured the activity of neurons in a human, another epileptic patient. And they had to decide which part of the brain is gone and whether epileptic seizures and so on. And they measured the activity of neuron in hippocampus while they presented a bunch of pictures to this patient. No places. They showed pictures of places too, but they also showed pictures of actors and actresses and so on. And turns out that neurons in this part of the brain responded very reliably to specific faces of actors. And there was one neuron they called Jennifer Aniston neuron. That's the way it turned out. They couldn't have any choice on that. I wish they did. That neuron fired only when there was a picture of Jennifer Aniston and didn't spike at any other time. And in fact, it was even more fascinating that even when they put up the word Jennifer Aniston, not the picture, the neuron still responded. So now that starts to get interesting, that now how there are still many, many issues remaining. But now in human, you have one thing, Jennifer Aniston neuron. When you ask the human to play a Pac-Man game, on a video screen, you ask a human to move a cursor, you find neurons fired at specific places, more or less like this, on a virtual screen. So there is space, there are these other events. We still want to get to some more things for learning. So it's a complex thing. And the idea being that perhaps hippocampus's role is to generate maps in more dimensional space than just two. And we're going to get into that in a minute. Any questions? Yeah.
That Jennifer Aniston neuron does other things at other times, or is it just
no? In their experiment, it did only that.
It sits there all the time.
Sits there, doesn't do anything, and you throw the picture. It gets more funny actually. If they show a picture of Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt, the neuron actually shuts down. That's the way it shakes. So highly specific. I know. In fact, people would have been much happier if, you know, these neurons were responding to Eiffel Tower or some place. Because then everything would have fitted with this rat world of place cells. Where it was coding for faces, worthless faces, and so on. So there it goes. And there are many, many more studies. People have later on asked patients to recall names, free recall, to say, now you tell me what are the thoughts that are going through your mind. And I showed you a bunch of clips, and you tell me which clips you are thinking of. And unknown to patient, you're recording the data, and whenever the patient says, I'm thinking of this place, this neuron, like patient says, there are videos online available, so I'm thinking of Tom Cruise in an Oprah Winfrey show. This neuron goes, brrr, spikes like hell. He talks about other things, the neuron doesn't fire. Once again, he talks about Tom Cruise in Oprah show, same neuron shows up. So it's not just external stimuli. And that's an important point that comes out of this, that these neurons are not just doing all this based on external stimuli, they're doing a lot of things on their own. All right, so lots of interesting stuff. So let's get back to this story of this place.
So yeah. Are these neurons on the hippocampus, or these were in neocortex and ventral?
So far, the place cell that I'm talking about, as well as more or less all the neurons that I talked about in human, we are talking about in hippocampus. We are going to get to this entorhinal cortex in a second. Yeah? So what is it that drives these neurons?
I thought the hippocampus was not where the memories were stored.
That's right. That's right. That's how it is. We are going to get into that. Right. So these are the neurons which are responding to stimuli. Your question is, where is memory into this? And where is the memory going? We are going to get into that. Okay?
So it looks like what you're saying is that for each object, if you want to, like, for each particular object that you learn or try to remember, there's a particular neuron that gets associated with it. But then what happens as you lose memory of that object or that particular event over a particular period of time? Does that neuron just stop?
So hang on for now. There is no memory here, right? There is no memory. All that is there is there is a stimulus, right?
You were saying that you don't even have to have a stimulus, right?
You could, that's right. So I'm going, I'm saying let's...
I'm thinking about this particular object, let's say I could call it that there's just one particular neuron that's going to be spun up. So it looks like the brain has associated one particular neuron.
Not just one. Not just one. Just because one measured the activity of one neuron, one doesn't assume that it's just one neuron responding to it. Mm-hmm. Roughly, the estimate is that about 1% of neurons will respond to certain stimuli. 0.0, 0.5 to 1% of neurons will respond to some combination of stimuli. So it's not the case that there is only one neuron responding to a stimulus, nor is the case that one neuron will respond to only one stimulus. Even though in these experiments that was the case, because the set of objects is infinite, set of stimuli is infinite, just because they didn't measure, that's not the case. And in these experiments where people can, you know, human patient, you can do experiment only for half an hour, but here if I were to run the rat in a different environment, different set of neurons will be active, and some of them will be active in multiple environments. So it's a distributed code. Same neuron participates in multiple memories, but not all of them. And one memory is not represented by just one neuron, but by many. Yeah? Okay? So now the question is, what's driving it? And what is driving it, based on this discussion, you can clearly tell, is going to be based on two class of things. One is internal, something which is inside the brain, synapses, neurons, excitation, inhibition, and one is external. External is stimuli, whether it's a picture of one actress or actor or the stimuli on the wall. So this story already started to get pretty complicated early on. So they had this rat running around, and they had these four different cues on the walls. As they changed the cues, the neurons changed. If they rotated the cues, neurons rotated with the cues, suggesting visual cues are driving them, and it's pretty straightforward, and then inside stuff is doing something. Well, it turns out that if you turn off the lights completely, the neuron more or less continues to fire where it was. So it can't just be external, or maybe it is external, but the neuron is not just responding to the light, it's also responding to the smells, it's also responding to the sound. In fact, Feynman had done experiments on navigation, which is covered in his book, Surely You're Joking, that rats could navigate by hearing the sound of their footsteps, actually. That's what he found in an experiment that he was talking about. So, could be many things. So this gets pretty interesting as to what is driving the cells. But one clear thing is that if you mess with this distal landmarks, the places more or less follow. But that's not the whole story. In addition to that, several people found that there were neurons which were not only responding to where the rat is, but these neurons were also responding to head direction of the rat. So no, this neuron, for example, in hippocampus, there are neurons will fire in one place, no matter which way he's looking, more or less. Whereas you go to a neighboring part of the brain, whose name I won't tell you, those neurons don't care where the rat is, they care for which way he's facing. So as long as he's facing north, one neuron will spike a lot. As north faces east or west, this neuron doesn't fire. And another set of neurons starts to fire for that. So now you have two components to building a map. One is a set of neurons, which tell you roughly where you are. Another is a vector component, which is head direction cells. So based on this, people came up with lots of interesting theories. And I want to tell you just quickly, without getting into too much detail of those theories. And those theories are based on so-called attractor networks, which are related to Ising model. Basically, it says that if you take a bunch of neurons, let's say this is the firing rate of neuron I, it is equal to some bunch of things plus some synaptic strength or synaptic weight, Wij, times the input from other neurons, J. These are all excitatory. And imagine each neuron's firing rate is some cosine, some Gaussian. And if you arrange this synaptic strength in a line, not in anatomical space, but in physical space, let's imagine one-dimensional example, then if this neuron I is here, then connection of this neuron with another neuron I plus 1 or I minus 1 is very strong, and these connections are very weak. Then this network will generate a dynamic so that if you throw in a weakly tuned input, it will localize it and say, I'm here. So these are one set of theories. So now we are getting into relating these theories to experiments. So one set of theories about how the brain forms maps of space or maps of other events and so on is so-called attractor networks, which says that everything is being done based on this connectivity pattern. That's where all the magic is. In very caricature term, there are hybrid theories too. But it says that essentially the way the brain works is these neurons are some simple nonlinear processes. We can approximate even their nonlinearity and say we just replace the nonlinear behavior by mean firing rates. That rate code or rate function, and this is the average rate, it's just a sum of bunch of inputs and some inhibition which keeps them in control. So that's a simple idea. But it turns out there are a whole other class of theories which says that actually the way the brain works is not, especially the spatial coding, is not based on this connection strength, but it is based on the complexity of the neuron itself. Because this neuron itself, while in this theory we are replacing the neuron by a point particle, and on top of it we are replacing the firing rate by some average cost, average activity rate function, these crazy patterns and there's a whole lot of ion channels and so on in the dendrites, they are going to be quite crucial. And that started to change very recently. So it turns out that while these experiments were going on, when people stuck an electrode and they found these amazing maps of space, they found one more thing, which they were not really bargaining for. And actually that one more thing was known even before spatial maps were formed, which is that if you don't even listen to one neuron, you stick an electrode in the brain and pick up the activity of lots of neurons, you don't care one neuron or another, just take the average, what you find are oscillations. So I don't know where to put that, perhaps here. So you find oscillations going on in the brain, and these oscillations have a wide range of rhythms. So for example, when the rat is sitting around doing nothing in the same arena, there's not any clear rhythm in the hippocampus, some irregular activity. As soon as it starts to run, you get an activity pattern which is more or less 8 hertz, very precise. From rat to rat, from day to day, from session to session, it's pretty sharply tuned around 8 hertz. It's not a sinusoid, it is a broad range, it goes more or less from 6 to 12 hertz. But this is a very common rhythm. It appears whenever the rat is running, he goes to sleep, the rhythm goes away. And as soon as he actually goes into the dreaming stage of sleep or rapid eye movement stage, the same rhythm reappears. So it appears in a specific behavioral state, you have these different rhythms. So somehow the brain is generating these rhythms, and at the same time, brain, and that's your time now. That's one aspect of time, is this rhythm that brain is generating. And the question is, now what? So how do we start putting these things together, and how do we get into these memory formation and so on? So one idea was that, well, what are these neurons doing? How did these maps arise? We don't really know that. We are still working on it, we as a field. But one question that puzzled people right from early on is that using this fancy technology where they put lots of electrodes in hippocampus and measured the activity of 100 neurons simultaneously, they had another major surprise, which is valid for many, many parts of the brain, which is that even though in this part of the brain there are about 10 raised to 5 neurons, 10 raised to 5 to 10 raised to 6 to 6 neurons, just with 100 neurons, you can predict where the rat is with a greater accuracy than he himself can tell you where he is. So this can't simply be a question of redundancy. Brain cannot be just putting in so many more neurons just for redundancy, because there are way too many. And it's not just that if the rat, instead of walking around in 2 square meters, if he walked around 1,000 square meters, that will be a problem, because the idea is that neurons are representing information not based on the activity of one neuron, nor the average activity of lots of neurons, but by a vector of activity patterns. So at every position, this is called the population vector.
Can I ask a question, sorry, about the 8 hertz?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so does this frequency vary with the age of the rat? I'm really thinking of the size of the rat, so it's very young rat?
Not too much. By far, not as much as the age changes. It does change with running speed.
So how does a wet, squishy environment of the brain hang on to a frequency like that throughout its
life? Great question, that's right. Yeah. So how does it generate this frequency? Why is that frequency varying in a systematic way with behavior? So there are ideas that you can, so there's a simple answer and a complex answer. The simple answer is you can take just one neuron. And in the neuron, as I was mentioning, there are several ion channels here. These ion channels themselves can balance off each other and they can generate a pretty reliable pattern. Then you can make it more robust by connecting a whole lot of neurons and you can make the pattern more robust. The key thing is how does it keep working in presence of noise? And how does it remain flexible at the same time remain reliable? That's an interesting question. But yes, one case, there's a whole field of how neurons generate rhythms, and this is not the only case where rhythms are generated. When you're walking right from the spinal cord onward, there are different rhythms being generated all the time. Okay? So the idea is that neurons are now representing information by the activity pattern of many, many neurons in a vectorial fashion. So if I have 100 neurons, there is one set of patterns. So this is activity pattern of neuron number one, of neuron number two, and then of neuron number n. At a different place now, as you go, this is position number one, that's position number two. This will become A1 prime, this will become A2 prime, and so on and so forth, and AN prime. And even though these differences between these can be very small, you can clearly represent the position of the animal very precisely by these combinatorics. And people do see this combinatoric code change as a function of position. So there is that puzzle as to why do we have so many neurons? If these many are quite sufficient and very dumb code, you don't even need a very sophisticated code to figure out where the rat is. Just take the average activity. So why do we have so many neurons? So one idea that some people, including I, have been proposing is that maybe this is not the main thing this part of the brain is doing. So we can do a thought experiment right now. So I'm in front of you, and I were to move, let's say, my finger in front of you, and I were to catch it, ask you to catch it. You will do it if I was close enough. And let's say this is an average speed, just 1 meter per second, not a huge speed at all. Now, if the brain was functioning as we discussed so far, which is that there are some external stimuli that are coming in, there is some internal dynamics, the brain puts it together and generates a certain response. If that's what you were doing, we will all be dead right now. So why is that? So imagine this. This thing is moving at the rate of 1 meter per second in one direction. You're going to catch it. Let's now digitize this. So this is at t equals 0. This is at 100 milliseconds. This is 200 milliseconds and so on. And even if you are the fastest monkey in the world who is really wanting that drop of apple juice, it takes you at least 1/4 of a second from the moment that stimulus came in to the moment you reach out and touch the subject or touch the stimulus. In that much time, this thing would have moved 25 centimeters and you'll always be doing this. You'll never do this. And now, of course, you can catch this, you can walk. So pretty much all the time, no matter what you're doing, it's a strong statement, you're always actually anticipating the future stimulus, whatever it is in complex dimensional space, based on your past huge bank of memory, based on the gravity, what's the height of your heels, what's the strength of your hands, what is the orientation of the slope, how fast this is moving, how strong your back is so that you don't fall back or forward, your center of gravity doesn't shift. You're doing really complex things to predict what is that future thing that's going to be. And that's what is actually the important one. It is not where you are, but what you're learning in any given environment is the path. Which in very simplest term, in a binary term, could be causality. What is cause and effect? That's what you're learning. And in a more complex sense, you're learning complex temporal sequences. Path being one complex temporal sequence, there could be other complex temporal sequences too. So several people have developed theories of how these networks of neurons, instead of telling you where you are, can learn what's going to happen next. And constantly, like a relay team, keep telling you what's going to happen next. And it turns out that there is specific properties of these synapses. These synapses, the way they learn, is actually not symmetric. The arrow of time in the way these synapses learn is not symmetric. depending on the input neuron's activity and the output neuron's activity, the synapse can tell the time, which happened first and which happened second, in a dramatically different way, all or none, positive or negative. And if you incorporate into these theories, you can tell how your brain will learn causality. And how is it that your brain will start telling you what is going to happen next based on what happened in the past? And roughly speaking, that's one class of theories. Now, those theories required that if you want to learn actually what's going to happen next, these neurons are going to be very, very precise. They care for the input and output neurons' activity with an accuracy of 5 milliseconds. So how the hell are you going to generate the activity of neurons which is synchronized or coordinated on the time scale of 5 milliseconds, while I just told you that neurons are representing information by this random noise? Kind of stochastic way. How do you reconcile the two, that on the one hand, neural activity is pretty noisy, on the other hand, the way neurons learn depends very crucially on timing of inputs. So we need to solve that problem of space and time. Time of the order of a couple of milliseconds. And space, which lasts over seconds. So several people suggested that, well, these rhythms that are going on when the rat is running around, that rhythm can play a role. So if you somehow sum up, and we can get into the details for those who want, but if you can drive the neurons at different rates, and then the inhibition, the inhibitory excitation, this inhibitory rhythm that's going on, that can read out the timing of inputs. So that these ideas started to resonate, and way before that, people found that when you start looking at the information contained in where the rat is, you don't just have information about the mean activity level of a neuron, but you also have information about time with respect to the rhythm. So here is how. So this is worth a picture. So if you took this 8 hertz rhythm, imagine the rat walk through this space. So this is now time, and here's the 8 hertz rhythm going by. And if you now notice the spiking from one neuron, and this is the average activity of, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand neurons. One electrode is measuring that. And if you now notice the spiking activity of one neuron, what it does is that right here, it spikes. The first spike, as the rat enters this place field, let's imagine this neuron spikes only when the rat is in this region, in one dimension, doesn't spike anywhere else. The first spike occurs here. The second spike occurs here. The third here, and the fourth here. So notice if this is legible, yeah? So what's going on is, so if you now draw these peaks of this, what you see is that as the rat enters, and if you adopt a phase convention, you call 0 and you call this 2 pi, then spikes occur more or less at 2 pi, and then the phase systematically keeps advancing to earlier and earlier phases as the rat is walking through the place field. So you now have information not only in terms of where the rat is in space, but also not just the overall activity pattern, but the phase of the ensemble. With respect to that, there is information, and this is very precise. This is precise within about 10 milliseconds, whereas from here to here is about 1 second, so far more precise. That's now a different way in which these neurons are keeping information. Not only in terms of the overall activity rate, which waxes and wanes, sometimes the neuron fires 2 spikes, sometimes 1, but on top of that, there's information in this phase. So based on that, people are very excited. They said, well, how can this come about? Well, one easy way in which this can come about is if in the brain, in addition to this one oscillator that's going on, there is another oscillator somewhere, whose frequency, if this oscillator's frequency is F1, the other oscillator's frequency is F1 plus delta F. And if you add these up, you'll get these interference patterns. So that was interesting. And a whole lot of discussions that we have had about how can this work. Because on one hand, these oscillations are highly noisy. Their frequency keeps shifting around. How can you have interference pattern if the signal itself is not monochromatic? So that's one problem. Second problem is, how can network of neurons do that? If each one is going at 8 hertz, how can they systematically go faster than that? So a whole bunch of experiments were done, and we discussed many of those here. So one experiment was that, well, there are these interesting ion channels inside the neurons. And these ion channels themselves endow each neuron to speed up or slow down with respect to the ensemble. So a bunch of people, there was a whole lot of theory and experiments. They came up with a way they generated a transgenic animal. So that's a bunch of fascinating technological tools people have developed to knock off a gene by which they got rid of that ion channel which should speed up or slow down that neuron. Now, if everything was true, then when you knock out this gene, this timing code should go away. And if this timing code was really important, the mouse should be really messed up. Well, none of that happened. In fact, the opposite happened. The timing code actually got better. And the mouse actually learned better than the normal animals. So those results kind of put the whole very nice, simple theory into serious question. So how the hell did people do something to make this guy better? Let alone the theory not working, what's going on? And there are interesting stories there about how that happens. And now another story that went along with it is that here, on the other hand, going for the strength of this theory that if you have these two oscillators, one is going F1, another F1 plus delta F, when you add them up, not only will you get this interference pattern, but this pattern should keep repeating many, many times. That's a prediction, which didn't happen in hippocampus because neurons fired at only one place, not at multiple places. So where is the equivalent of F1 minus, what is the equivalent of the delta F? Where do we see that? Why don't we see the beats that go on? So it turns out that some people who are measuring the activity of neurons in this part of the brain called entorhinal cortex, they found a remarkable thing. They found that these neurons were not just have place cells, but these place cells were distributed along the vertices of a hexagonal or a triangular lattice, which was a huge discovery around by Edward Moser and Margaret Moser. So let's take the same experiment that I drew there. And now this is in the entorhinal cortex. And you have a rat that's wandering around randomly all over the place. And if you listen to now one neuron only, this neuron will be active here, but it will also be active here, then also active here, then here. So I'm going to be drawing circles like that, so on. So if these activity patterns fall on the vertices of this triangular lattice. So that was a puzzle, surprising, because this rat is now moving around at all kinds of speed. And he's running at all kinds of speed, his running speed, his head direction, all kinds of things are changing. But this one single neuron, when it spikes, it doesn't spike at just one place, but spikes at multiple places. And these multiple places are distributed periodically. So how can this work? One idea was that, well, this is your delta F, more or less. But the delta F is in time. Whereas to go from here to here, it can take him arbitrary amount of time. He can take a circuitous route, so that won't work. So people had to make more assumptions about that to say, well, this other oscillator has to depend on running speed. So there is this idea that runs through the subject to say, well, if there are multiple oscillators in the brain, these oscillators must be under some control of behavior somehow. So that's one key direction of studies that is going on. But nevertheless, and this will keep us busy for many years, and another major discovery that came about is that, well, so one of the highly contested ideas was these two things. Turns out, the result came which clarified this thing from a completely different direction. So all these studies, place cell, and these cells, by the way, are called grid cells, because they fire at multiple places, forming a hexagonal lattice. So what's the mechanism of grid cells? What's the mechanism of place cells? How do the two relate to each other? Big field of discussion, but seemed to be, several theories suggested, it all got to do with this theta rhythm and interference. So somehow this timing component generated by this rhythm is playing a role in generating all the space. Turns out that people, all these measurements were in rats and mice, in one group of people in Israel, decided to record cells in bats, totally different species. Turns out, good news is first, that bats have beautiful place cells. They have beautiful grid cells, but they have no theta rhythm at all. Pretty much zero. This thing is pretty much gone. So that challenges this theory quite a bit. So could it be interference if the rhythm is pretty much empty? And people discuss maybe the rhythm is not periodic, it is periodic, the frequency has shifted, so on and so forth. And these discussions continue, and in the meantime, I know that I'm running out of time, so I want to tell you another aspect of the whole thing, which is, I told you so far what happens during behavior. When the animals are exploring space. But there are several questions that remain. These are the things that happen when the animal is doing something in space. What happens if you constrain the animal? You ask the animal to remember something. You ask the animal to do something. So what people did is actually made a maze of certain shape, and I don't want to get into those discussions of the shape of the maze and so on. And all that it is, put the rat in one place, and in the middle of the maze, they put a treadmill. Here's a treadmill, and here's a rat on it. And they just let the rat run on this treadmill. So he's standing on the treadmill in the middle of the maze, and he's running along. And they find phenomenally interesting result that if you look at the neuron as a function of time, this is time from the moment that he got onto the treadmill and started running, this neuron will remarkably fire at a certain time. Many, many times you do, this neuron will fire more or less, say at 5 seconds, and there'll be another neuron, they'll fire more or less at 10 seconds and so on and so forth. So now the space is taken out. Maybe the rat is thinking about where he's going. That's actually the hypothesis these people suggest. But if the rat is in just one place, he's running on the running mill or a treadmill, the neuron fires reliably, one neuron at 5 seconds, another at 10, a third one at 1 second, and so on and so forth. Same neurons, the same neurons which are firing as a function of position are now firing as a function of time, seeming. So is it time? Or is it that the rat's brain or the neurons are actually counting footsteps? Is it something called path integration or locomotion integration? Yes, sir.
If you did this experiment with a rat absolutely immobile and just created an optic flow.
That's an interesting experiment.
What would you see?
Hasn't been done as far as I know, but there is one interesting caveat. Because turns out that that theta rhythm that I told you will be gone if the rat is stationary. And when the rat is stationary, and thank you for asking this question because this lets me segue into the last part. I know we are running out of time and this is a long set of interesting stuff, which is what happens when the rat is stationary. I told you one part of the story that when the rat is stationary, this theta rhythm is gone. But it turns out that the hippocampus activity is not entirely random when the rat is stationary. So we have again an electrode in hippocampus, same electrode that's showing you this theta rhythm. We let the rat be on his own, just become stationary. Turns out the activity develops a new rhythm, which appears very briefly, so even bigger than this, or more or less the same size. So what you see is this, that electrode which is going on, the activity is more or less going like this, and then boom. It's something like that, and if you look very closely, you see more or less 200 hertz rhythm for a very brief period, for about 100 milliseconds. So that is pretty much immobile. You can make sure he's sleeping, you can head fix it, so on and so forth. And in that brief period, and these events, avalanche-like events, where lots of neurons are active, but they're active more or less pretty rhythmically around 200 hertz, they appear more or less randomly. Suddenly there is an avalanche. The amplitude keeps varying. Lots of small avalanches, a few very large avalanches. They do form 1 over F raised to beta kind of a distribution. The interesting theory is about how these avalanches occur. And it turns out that if you looked during these avalanches, what is the activity pattern? So rat is now fixed in one place. He's not going anywhere. He's probably sleeping. It turns out that if there were two neurons, one neuron, let's say when the rat was running, let's again make a one-dimensional example. Let's take two neurons. So let's say one neuron that was active here is another neuron that's active afterwards. This is when he was running. If you look carefully, when the rat is sleeping, this whole sequence of the green neuron, let's call it A, and this orange neuron, let's call it blue, B, they'll fire more or less in the same sequence, more often than not, when the rat is sleeping. These are called replays, because the behavioral pattern which takes from here to there, this is about 1 second, the whole thing replays about 40 times faster. So this takes about 20 milliseconds, spontaneously. So what, and the idea is that when these replays are going on, that is where the animal is trying to throw this information that it acquired during behavior back to neocortex. And there are interesting experiments that several people in the audience and others have done, that if you mess with these avalanches, and if you mess with this replay, the animal's memory next day actually gets worse. So there's something going on. Of course, a lot more needs to be tested. You have messed with the avalanches themselves, which is changing the circuit quite a bit. But this gets you a whole loop. It should give you some idea of the going from the entire loop, starting from there is something going on one time scale of behavior when the rat's wandering around, to stuff that the brain is doing on its own, much faster, around 40 to 50 times faster, when the rat is not doing anything. And our challenge in the field is to link these together. And in my mind, the biggest challenge is to come up with a clear way to test theories. So I mentioned a couple of these theories here, but what we need are theories which can be tested quantitatively, so that it's not just one prediction or another, but we have quantitatively testable predictions. And this was a lot of discussions in the meeting that are about quantitatively testing things. So I'll stop here. I've finished exactly 1 hour. Any more questions? Thank you.
So going back to the rat experiment of place cells and grid cells, if one were to increase the size of the experiment, the expectation is that the firing zone map will be homologous, or will increase the number of firing zones?
Very good question. So there are, it depends. There are several interesting questions, results that have come out. So let me give you a short answer. The short answer is that as long as you have an environment like this, a box, let's say, you have a box, and imagine you have a place cell that's locked right near this wall. If you now started to stretch this to this size wall, this thing will go with it. But if on the other hand, you had another neuron which was active here, then that neuron will actually stretch. So the idea is that it's kind of sum of two Gaussians. And if it is very close to one Gaussian, then it will pretty much go with it. Whereas if it is in the middle, it's getting driven by both Gaussians, it's going to stretch. The story gets really interesting and complex in terms of these grid cells. It depends on where you are in the grid map. So it turns out that this grid spacing is not fixed. Depending on where you are in the brain, this grid spacing actually changes. And it seems to be quantized. So the spacing between grids tends to be roughly 4 different spacing and a shift around them. And depending on how big is the spacing, these guys will do different things. But that's way more than you bargain for, so I won't throw more at you.
Question.
Yeah.
So many of us have places that are very familiar. So you can say, imagine you're sitting, you know, at your couch at home. If you do that experiment with someone, do the place cells fire?
So we did an experiment, yeah. So we did an experiment where what we did is within 2 trials. So it simplified to say here is a rat and he has to run on this track from here to there about 1 meter long. He runs from here to there trial number 1 and he runs from here to there trial number 2. It's already familiar. So what you find is a variety of new things that happen within 2 to 3 trials. So the first thing that happens is, so broadly speaking, if I were to draw something like this, so if the rat's going from here to there, the firing rate in the first trial looks something like this, then within 2 to 3 trials, the firing rate will look something like this. It'll become asymmetric, and it'll anticipate. So rat's going from here to there. This cell will start to tell you what's going to happen next. And it starts to fire a lot more, about twice as much. And its shape acquires this ramping shape. And we believe that actually plays a role in predicting where you're going to be. Already the cell appearing earlier, it every step starts to tell you where you're going to be rather than where you are.
But if I may, the only experiments we heard about in primates, actually, from the University of Washington,
yes,
are experiments in which the place cells are seen in response to images of place.
That's right.
The animal is not moving, so they are not associated with movement.
But in there, the animal is moving the eyes.
He's moving the eyes. In
so,
but it's all external stimulus.
External stimulus.
You don't know because you can't do the experiment. Yeah. So, asking if your place cells fire when you're imagining the location. Yeah.
But it, so the closest I can say is
the only primate experiment.
Or human experiment that I mentioned. Yeah. So you ask the, you show the human being a bunch of video clips, and you ask them to recall one of the video clips. Whenever the human being recalls that video clip, one specific neuron will fire the light.
Yeah, that's explosive. Place cells, yeah.
Like space, but it's the same neurons as place cells that they are doing this. But this experiment, I don't know yet. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's some emerging paradigm for the brain, because what you say about anticipating, I've also heard in visual recognition software and things like that. So is there something that is agreed that this is how it works? Or,
agreed, I would not, that's pushing too far. Largely because of challenges. I think broadly speaking, people agree that one needs to focus on three or four things. One needs to pay more attention to neurons themselves. That one should not just be treating neuron as a point particle. One should be taking into account these non-linearities and the dendrites and so on, which are quite important. In fact, several talks next this week will talk about how the dendrites themselves can generate their own spikes, which can influence everything profoundly. So we can't just take them as just some pipes which are schlepping things around. So that's one thing. And the other thing people agree is that these network interactions need to be considered more carefully, rather than just some Ising model. Because Ising model has many strengths, but has several weaknesses specified when you're applying here. So we need to do that too. That I would say, if I were to say consensus of this 4 weeks and two more to go, is that we need to be more serious about these things. It's hard. It's not that people are lazy. It's hard to integrate these things because you have explosion of parameters.
Please. Yeah. How much is it difficult to simulate the presence of the space?
Yeah.
Just giving the suitable signals to neurons.
So several people started doing this. So they created virtual reality. So you put the rat on a big ball. There's a huge ball like that, and you exercise the rat. And then as the rat, you hold the rat fixed in one place. And now as the rat starts to run, you pick up this big bunch of sensors, and then you project the image, and now you can do pretty funny things. And it's a huge interesting thing, but the bottom line is that when you do that, you do find place cells, reliably. But if you look carefully, these actually cells are not coding places, they are coding distances. They are counting relative distance, not place. So now the problem turns upside down. How do you get place instead of this relativity in the brain where neurons are counting relative distances, which is nice because relative distance is of course invariant. How do you get back place? But that's another long story.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering how microscopic you think you have to go for certain things you're interested in. And you mentioned that maybe you shouldn't treat a neuron as a, you know, Ising spin. I want to look at what's happening in dendrites. Does it matter what the distance between iron channels is, for example? I mean, is that
so
important?
Yeah.
So from, you know, when might it be important? Or
yeah, my feeling is that right now this is going to be, you know, as you go from these things, you look at these grid cells, and there are border cells, and there are boundary vector cells, and so on. There's an explosion of cells. And in my mind, if I were to draw any analogy, this is like the days of pi mesons. We had a huge number of them. It started very simple. We had protons and neutrons, and now there's an explosion of things that start looking. And we'll have to be, that's why we'll have to do smart reduction. So what is the minimal theory that I will make? But I'm going to justify why am I going to ignore this ion channel, or why am I going to ignore the whole neuron? Why am I going to use this point neuron if I must? So that I can come up with some quantitative understanding, which is falsifiable. I think that should be the emphasis. And people are doing this more and more. And that's a challenge, because you have to do both. On one hand, you have to know all this complexity. And then on the other hand, you say, I'm going to throw away this million things in a smart way. And then iteratively bring that back.
So in the beginning, you set up the whole discussion that this is all about that age-old problem of the brain-mind problem. What I think you've been talking about here is more of a brain behavior problem, and you kind of drilled in fantastic ways, telling us about cell behavior, dendrites, ion channels, and such. Question is, can experiments like this ever have any bearing at all on sort of the rat's experience of space?
Yes. So people are doing that already. Again, this is happening. What I talked about, again, is very limited of representation of everything that people did. But what you can now do is, instead of the rat wandering around randomly, you can ask him to do a specific thing, such as go to this place, and that he has to go to that place based on memory or based on previous experience. And then we can look at how the dynamics of neurons is changing. And we can manipulate specific ion channels or neurotransmitters to see how do we relate the change in neurons' dynamics as the function of experience as he's learning it. We can relate the change in neural dynamics to behavior. And this has been done by several people in the audience, and we have done this too. Especially in virtual space, it becomes much more controllable. So the reason I've been talking about these experiments, which are either random walking or walking in a straight line, is because there are so many stimuli. And if the rat's behavior itself is changing, now we don't know, is it because of changing behavior or is it due to stimuli? But yes, this is actually happening, and I can tell you more about people's efforts in relating the neural dynamics to behavior, not just neural activity to behavior, but dynamics to behavioral choices.
That's my final question.
Okay. I think it's general, is that once you are talking about this interference, possible interference, right, then could be some kind of appearance of like coherence, for example, where it's not just one, but many neurons working, and then a signal would be like a square, not linear in number of neurons. So any kind of phenomena which could be associated with this coherent behavior.
Coherent behavior, we saw some of it. So I'm not sure I fully understand the question.
No, I mean that because it's either at the level of one individual neurons, or you can have,
It is coherent, yes. So if you looked at the activity of all the neurons together, you will see this warping signal. So these individual oscillations of neurons are indeed synchronous, or coherent, as you wish. Yes, quite coherent. And in all of them, and those coherent oscillations are in wide band of frequencies, all the way from 8 hertz down to up to 200 hertz. And they're pretty coherent, yes.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.